what I had seen very quickly with a small team and a very small pool of funds that we were already, you know, generating revenue, you know, in that year of close to €1 million.
Hey, how are you? Welcome to the Entrepreneur Experiment podcast with me, Gary Fox. The Entrepreneur Experiment helps you understand the secrets and systems world-class founders use to build their body, their business, and their brain. Today, we have Fox Squared. I'm joined by Dan Fox, the man behind Johnson Hanna. If that name is familiar, you will know them from having raised over €15 million, being one of the biggest success stories come out of Ireland in the last 5 years. And they're one of the most innovative companies, I would say ideally placed with the advent of AI to become a superstar in the business world. They do managed legal solutions. And what that means is essentially they're adding tech to the legal system to trim out a huge amount of cost and bureaucracy and add pace and efficiency. This is an incredible chat. Dan used to be a barrister. Then he became a special advisor to a high net worth individual and then became, had the light bulb moment and became the CEO and founder of Johnson Hanna. This is a really fascinating chat. And we go to a lot of places. Here is my chat with Dan Fox. First, a quick thank you to my incredible partners, Iconic.
If you're a regular listener of the pod, which I hope you are, you'll know I've been hosting the podcast from Iconic offices for quite a while now, and things have gone really, really well. So well, in fact, that I'm now a member of Iconic offices, working and recording from one of their spaces. This means I can vouch for the benefits it gives to any business. On that note, Iconic offices have given me a number of exclusive complimentary day office trials for my audience. So try it out for yourself for the day. Bring your team. No catches. Simply go to the web link in the description and enter Gary23, so it's Gary23, to claim your complimentary office for a whole day. It's a pretty fantastic offer. Thank you, Iconic offices.
Dan, welcome to the pod. I feel like this is pod number two. We've already had like pod number one.
I feel like I've nothing else to say, to be honest.
I always do that. That is entirely my fault. Every single time I get so excited when I meet someone new and someone I get on with, I'm like, oh, and this and this and this. But welcome.
Thank you very much. I'm genuinely thrilled to be here.
I'm delighted. I'm absolutely delighted. Just give a quick overview of what it is that you do.
So I am Dan Fox, CEO, co-founder of Johnson Hanna. So we set the business up in 2017 to challenge and disrupt the status quo within the legal industry. I know we've talked about this already, but to give you a bit of further background in terms of the market for legal services in Ireland and actually in pretty much every other country in the world, it's quite traditionalist. It can be slow moving and it tends to be quite old fashioned. So we set up a community of flexible working lawyers, complemented by technology, project management, and basically what we were trying to do was create a system where we could take on the work that big law firms should never have been doing, and use our community of flexible talent to do that work. And I guess for us, the mission, I guess it was a dual track mission. It was one, could we get flexible working lawyers to take on that work that law firms should never have been doing? And in doing so, allow them to work in more flexible ways, basically, and restore that work-life balance piece. But the second piece was reducing legal spend for corporate legal departments, and helping to get work off the desks of law departments who were just bogged down in a huge amount of non-bespoke routine legal work.
You don't look like a lawyer.
Do you know what? I qualified as a lawyer, but I don't necessarily consider myself a lawyer. I've been working in the legal industry for a long time, for probably over a decade now, actually. But it's kind of been in a peripheral way. And it's been, you know, looking at ways to challenge the way things are being done, and figure out a better way to deliver, within the legal ecosystem.
How you said there about the work that they shouldn't be doing. What work shouldn't they be doing?
So much legal work is non-bespoke, and it's more routine in nature. And I think this has been a big driver for us is around educating the broader marketplace that this was the case, this is the case. And there should be a distinction made between the really kind of bespoke advisory piece that's up here and the more kind of non-bespoke work that sits beneath it. And actually, we estimate that about 70% of all legal work is non-bespoke. So in educating the marketplace that there is this distinction between these two things, actually you can really radically change things. And like, as I said, like, it's, you know, one about, okay, we can create an infrastructure where people can reduce legal spend for businesses of all shapes and sizes, from startup scale up through to Fortune 500. But bigger than that still is the idea that actually lawyers and legal professionals can work in more flexible ways. And it's not about that kind of rigid adherence to what people thought, you know, it meant to be a lawyer or a legal professional, which was working, you know, 18 hours a day in a cavernous building. And, you know, I always think, like, the, you know, the word association game of, if I say to you law or lawyer, you know, what words come to you? It's not balance, and it's not flexibility, and it's not necessarily harmony. So for me and the company, it's always been about, like, the bigger kind of overriding mission has always been about, how can we prove that even lawyers can be happy working within that industry?
Kind of makes sense now. Kind of the whole vibe, the whole aesthetic. If you're listening to this on Spotify or Apple, go on YouTube. You'll see what I mean. So why? Why did you want to do that? Like, was this something you were like, I hate this job, I hate what I'm doing, there's a better way? Or was this something you came at it kind of going, I wonder why that is?
So I qualified as a barrister in 2011 and or 2010. And I think what lots of people don't understand about newly qualified barristers in this country, and it's the same in other jurisdictions actually, but you're setting up your own business, and, you know, you're going down and you're in front of judges and you're taking cases on, but you are starting from ground zero, right? And so you're self-directed, you're setting up a business. And, like, I remember in those early years, I was loss making because you were paying fees to be down there, and you know, for the privilege of working.
What were you doing? Right? What areas were you working on?
I only did 2 years, right? So I was, and I was doing an apprenticeship. So I was doing everything that was given to me. And there was personal injuries, there was commercial stuff. Litigation was the biggest part of my apprenticeship.
So you're working underneath another barrister? Subcontracting in, or how does that work?
It's called deviling or pupillage.
Yeah.
So essentially you're an apprentice, and you're doing the kind of, I guess, the more routine parts of legal work for those people, because by and large they tend to be really busy and they don't have time to do everything. So you kind of fill that gap for them, and I guess the quid pro quo is you get the experience.
Yeah.
So that you can then go on to emulate their success and, you know, in time to come. So so I'm down there, and, you know, my family is there's lots of people in the legal industry within my family, from barristers and solicitors and judges. So there was always, like, a huge amount of kind of, I guess, encouragement around going down that career path. But it was really hard, and still is really hard for people. And, you know, when I figured out that there was very little money to be made, certainly in the kind of in the earlier years, I had to figure out a way to try and make some money to sustain my career down there. So a friend of mine who ended up setting up my first business with me, Dick, he said that he found this opportunity to work in one of the big law firms in Ireland. So, and he said there was a job there for me as well. So anyway, we went in there and we joined a group of about, I think there were 60 or 70 people working on this project, and it was non-bespoke, right? It was, you know,
when you say non-bespoke, what does that mean?
It means it's, you know, it's not a complex restructuring, or, you know, the really kind of bespoke advisory work that, you know, top tier partners, specialists, very specialist subject matter knowledge are giving to clients.
Okay. So it's kind of been done before, you're just tweaking it slightly. Is that the kind of idea?
It's more transactional. It's, you know, there's, you can, it's almost like you can, not to say that it's non-complex, but it's less complex than a kind of specialist piece of work. So like the stuff that we do would be like commercial contracting, reviews and negotiations. You're working off a defined criteria within a playbook.
I get you. Yeah.
Discovery as part of litigation was where the first business came from. So, you know, you've got the litigation piece, which is, you know, I guess the complex advice piece, you know, above it. But then there's this discovery element, which is all the documents that need to be reviewed as part of the broader litigation process. And, you know, and that's really volume heavy. And typically what happens in a law firm environment, if a law firm's undertaking this process, is that paralegals, you know, junior barristers, junior solicitors start doing that review work themselves, right? So I went in there, I joined this team of lots of people. And
was this an extra job now on top of what you're already
this
doing?
This was additional to what we were doing.
Okay.
So, but at the same time, like there's, you know, you've set up your own business, so you've got time, right? You're kind of, you're looking for work.
Right.
You know, it's like, so, so we went in there and we got engaged and we were doing like crazy hours. So it became our core focus for about 12 weeks. And we were doing like 70, 80 hour weeks and we were being paid €16.50 an hour. And we were in like this.
€16.50
an hour was the rate we were being paid. But we subsequently found out that the firm was charging our time out to the bank. So it was the bank was the client of the firm and the bank was paying about €300 an hour for our services, right? So like really quickly.
I like those margins.
Great margins. So really. So we became, you know, it was really obvious very quickly that the firms were really adept at cutting really strong margin. So anyway, and I noticed when I was in there, first of all, I noticed the scale of it. I was like, wow, there's this big project and there's so many people, and it was young barristers like me. It was young solicitors. There was paralegals. There was even partners and equity partners doing this work. And it absolutely didn't require the input of people at that level. It just didn't. It didn't stack up. So,
is this a volume thing? When you say work, what is being done? Like, is it just a volume that has to be read through or done or what?
It's a volume of documents. So, like, discovery as part of litigation. Basically, the idea is, you can ask for documents from the other side who you're in a fight with. And the reason you're asking for those documents is because you have a legitimate belief that document that you're asking for can strengthen your case or weaken the case of your opponent. Mm. That's the fundamental premise. So what tends to happen in large scale litigations is you're asking for lots and lots of documentation and you're combing through emails and you're,
okay.
You know, so that's kind of, so it can be, super volume heavy, depending on, you know, what work stream you're in. And in this particular case, it was really, really volume heavy. And there was boxes of documents and lots of people doing
that. That sounds horrible.
Yeah. It was incredibly intense. But, you know, I think like maybe the worst part about that experience, and in some ways I was really grateful for the experience because it went on to shape, you know, this business idea that we ended up having, right? But I think when we were in there, we had this kind of this exposure to lots of people who were, you know, certainly not living in harmony in terms of what they were doing with their lives. And it was this recurring theme of, I don't feel like my life is in balance and I'm doing 80 or 90 hours a week. We were talking to like lots of, you know, senior associate solicitors in this firm, 80, 90 hours a week. And while on the face of it, I'm getting paid a good salary. I always remember there was this one lady that I was speaking to and she was like, it feels, you know, I've done the math on it. I'm being paid like less than minimum wage, you know, for the hour. And she might've been tongue in cheek, but it was,
probably right. Like if you add in all the times, people don't add in commute times and stuff to their jobs.
Yeah.
You're kind of going, well, you're spending 2 hours each way commuting, so you're kind of doing 10-hour days.
Exactly. So it was pretty eye-opening. And I think, you know, and it also felt like chaos. It felt like there was no project management and coordination of this massive sprawling project. So I had lots of ideas and I was leaving that, you know, when I left that project, I left with a spring in my step because like I had money for the first time in a while. But I also, the bigger thing was I had an idea. And And the idea was, you know, can I create a platform where people can work in more flexible ways within the legal ecosystem, a way where lawyers can work and be happy while staying connected to the legal industry. But the second piece was obviously, is there a better way to deliver legal solutions to the buyers of legal services, being whether you're a bank or whether you're a startup or a scale-up or someone who's got, you know, legal challenges of a more routine nature?
Where do you think that mindset came from? Because that's not really the usual mindset when you get your first job. You just kind of like want to put your head down, assume they know what they're doing. Whereas you didn't. You looked at, you've said three different problems there you'd identified. Where do you think that mindset comes from? Were you looking for an idea, or how did that work?
Where does it come from? There's probably quite a lot of entrepreneurism in my family. So, you know, I don't know whether it's a learned thing or it's a genealogical thing. I'm not sure, but certainly, you know, I'd been exposed to that kind of culture of innovation. So I think that might have been it, but I also feel that I was probably, you know, I was probably never the right fit for, you know, a typical legal career. I always remember when I was in my first year, there was a really experienced lawyer down in the courts, and I always remember him saying, he's like, "You've got to cut that hair. You know, you can't be here."
That's like something from The Simpsons, shave those sideburns, yeah, strawberry. That's, yeah,
he was probably right, you know what I mean? Like, but it was, you know, even then I remember thinking, God, am I the right fit for this industry? So
I have a picture at home on my wall. It's from an Irish artist. His name escapes me. He'll come to me in a while. But I was in a shop in Temple Bar, and it's a black and white drawing of an office cubicles, just a row of office cubicles. And in the middle, there's this clown, and he's all colorful, and everything else is black and white. And he just turns to the manager walking by. He goes, "There's been a mistake. I'm not meant to be here." And I bought it instantly. Yeah. And I hung it up on my office, and I have it staring at me. So anytime I start to waver, or anytime I start to like doubt myself about my own career and my path, I look at that and go, "It's not you."
Yeah, totally.
You're not meant to be there.
So that's what it probably felt like from the get-go. But I was also, like, I remember feeling really passionately, still do, about trying to play a part in the betterment of that system. Because, you know, even at that time, you know, like my friend who I went on to set the business up with, there was, you know, we were all struggling, and it was an incredibly hard career, and it took a long time to get there. But then when we had that exposure to the law firm world, we could see, oh, well, like there's lots more of kind of this, you know, dissatisfaction with the way things are.
But there's money been made somewhere. But there's, so you could see that as well. So you had that insight.
And there's opportunity.
I think a lot of people do that, as in like, oh, there's an idea here. But they don't see the full picture. They don't see where the revenue can be, whereas you'd seen both.
Yes.
You'd seen, this is inefficient, kind of doesn't make sense, and there's a big pot of cash here if we can crack this.
Yes.
So what did you do next?
So we left the firm. I'd been talking to Dickie about this idea. He saw the opportunity too. And so we decided we would put a company together, and then we recruited in my brother Alex, who went on to set up the second company, Johnson Hanna, with me. And Alex was like, I mean, we were young, we were 24. Alex was like 19, you know, he was like still in college. So it was, you know, it was very much a kind of typical startup story. We're going to give this a go.
What was the idea?
The idea was, Let's focus on how we can radically reduce legal spend for corporates and law firms who are willing to buy the solution as well. And the idea was we would use a pool of outsourced talent. They would work in really flexible ways to do this work. So we'd be giving back that kind of restoration of work-life balance piece to them. We would give young barristers an opportunity to earn money in flexible ways, the same opportunities that I'd been given, that we'd been given. But maybe to work in, you know, in more flexible ways doing it. and also increase the money that was being paid to these people. Because, you know, the margins that the firms were making were, you know, it was wacky. So, and then we knew that there was existing technologies that we could utilize to, you know, make the processes more efficient. And we wanted to wrap a project management element around it too, because what we'd seen on that project was there's lots of, like, this is really not a legal, you know, it's not a legal work stream. It's nearly more project management. The focus needs to be more project management based. So that was the idea. And then, you know, but like, again, we learned the hard way, because like, we ran that company for about 3 years and it was bootstrapped. And we got funding from one of the local enterprise offices, who in fairness were amazing, because like, really, like, there wasn't a huge team of people behind this. This was like three people. And you know, they backed us. And actually, it's funny, because we got reintroduced to the very guy who backed us with that first check in the enterprise office. We were only reintroduced to last week. He's now our development advisor in Enterprise Ireland. So
I like that,
which is pretty cool. Yeah,
I like that. Like, it's funny, as you go through your career, suddenly you do start seeing good people cropping up again. Yeah. And you're like, I'm glad you've met it.
Yeah.
I'm glad you're here on the journey with me now.
Someone like that. And we've had it like throughout the last couple of years, of people who are willing to take a chance. You know, and there's a risk associated with four people, but they're willing to do that. So we always remember those people as part of the journey. So anyway, we ran that for a couple of years, and I always consider that a successful failure, because, you know, there was... It certainly wasn't, you know, it wasn't champagne and crayfish and Saint-Tropez and, you know, and all that stuff towards the end of it. But we were nearly kind of resuscitated by another outsourcing firm who liked the idea of bringing us in-house and allowing us to kind of grow the business from within. But so we did that, but we realised that...
So did they buy you out, take you on, take you over?
It was called a buyout, but in truth, it was a resuscitation. It was a lifeboat, right? Like, it was, you know, it was, we're struggling here. Like, that's the truth of it. Like, we were coming to the end of our tether. We had no funding. And that for us was an opportunity to, you know, get a wage and have the support of, you know, a more robust infrastructure. But we also, I mean, one of the things that we learned like along that journey was that there is such, it's so perilous to try and bootstrap a business in the absence of funding. I know it can make sense, but, you know, even in terms of delivery and getting the right team on the bus to deliver for the types of clients that we were winning, because we were, you know, against all odds, you know, we had this concept. It was very novel in Ireland. People were buying it. But we need to really kind of build and scale that. We need people delivering. You know, it needed to be better than what the law firms could do, better than what the consulting firms could do. And I think it's really, really hard to do that, and certainly do it in a quick way.
You were already bringing a new model to a traditional industry, but you probably needed elements of the traditional industry to come with you for credibility and for actual delivery.
Completely.
Okay.
Completely. Interesting. So like... You know, in terms of the Johnson Hanna model, like, one, we kind of, I mean, there was a couple of things happened. I went and, you know, I worked for a high net worth guy called Gary Kelleher after that for about a year. And he was, you know, a great entrepreneur in his time and a property entrepreneur.
What did you do with him, or how did that come about?
I was introduced to him through a friend of mine who was a recruiter, who said, like, you know, like, I know you've been doing this thing with the company. Garrett is, you know, he's a veteran property entrepreneur. He's, you know, he was involved in litigation at the time. So he had like multi cross jurisdictional litigations going on because he'd built this very vast property empire. And, you know, there was all the kind of 2008 economic crash and all that stuff was going on. So basically, I was going in there and he wanted me to do a few things. One was he wanted my experience having built a startup. I mean, he probably overvalued what I could really contribute at the time. But
probably respected it, though. I think there's a respect among fellow entrepreneurs.
Yeah, I think there was a piece of that. And, you know, he was interested in, you know, investments, and he had a number of different startups that he was kind of quasi part of, and he was helping put funds together for them. So I was sitting on a couple of boards.
You were like a chief of staff kind of role, or head of legal, or what was it?
It was, yeah, I mean, was it a chief? I don't know. Like, it was called strategic advisor.
Chief staff. Take both. That title's important.
The marketing piece. But
LinkedIn updated.
But it was really like multifaceted, and it was, you know, it was sitting on boards. It was, but a big part of it was he was curious about what I'd done with the first business, and he was looking at the opportunity for how we could save him on the cost of litigation.
Okay.
Right. So I had actually, during the course of working for him, I'd set up the next business. And he was cool with that because he saw that there was an opportunity that might be, you know, I guess, provide mutual benefit. So I ended up actually leveraging my relationship with him to raise funds for that business. And
so you'd learn from the first one you weren't going to bootstrap again.
I wasn't going to do it again.
Clear in your mind, you were like, no way.
Very clear.
Okay.
Absolutely no way. It's I mean, look, there's pros and cons, but I think the pros of raising money always outweigh the cons, in my view. So I raised money. Now, ultimately, I ended up buying that pot of investors out because I felt that they'd come in at a time where the valuation just, the true value of the company couldn't have been realized that early. So I ended up raising, I ended up taking a loan and buying them out very early on. And that
what
was,
kind of timescale are we talking about
really
here?
Really stressful. That was, I guess it was like 9 months post investment.
Wow, that's fast.
And we were revenue generating. Like we were like really.
So was this the first version of Johnson Hanna, or was this a previous business going up to?
No, it was the first version. Okay. But it was a really, like, it was embryonic. It was, you know, and...
That's ballsy, though, to set it up and then buy them out for 9 months.
Yeah, it was super stressful. And at the time, I was buying a house. We were having our first kid. Dickie from the first business was involved. Alex was involved as well. So, you know, the band was back together kind of thing. But it was really stressful. It really was. So anyway, but you know, at the same time, like it made sense at that point in time. And I think, you know, and Garrett respected it as well. And so anyway, I pulled the money together from investors who ultimately became my seed investors, took a loan off them, a personal loan, and I bought them out.
Personal loan.
Don't recommend that.
Those words that wake you up at 3 a.m.
Yeah, don't recommend that. So that was it. And then,
but you believed in it so much. You were like, this is the way, this is the only way this can be done.
Yeah, I believed that there was a major opportunity to challenge the industry. And what I had seen very quickly with a small team and a very small pool of funds that we were already, you know, generating revenue in our, you know, in that year of close to €1 million. And, you know, and so I fundamentally, I, you know, I had conviction around it.
Yeah. You weren't going on a hunch going, I think maybe, oh, isn't that a problem? Maybe.
I knew I could raise a proper fund.
Yeah.
I certainly believed I could. And so, you know, we went off, we did the buyback. And I remember one of the first things I did, I reached out on LinkedIn to, you know, one of our earliest investors who's become a very close friend of mine, Dan Kiley. And I...
Famous name in the entrepreneurial world.
Yeah, definitely. And in the outsourcing world too. And I pinged him a message on LinkedIn and I said, Dan, you know, I'm a big fan. I've...
Long time listener, first time caller.
You know, and I said, look, would you entertain me? Could I buy you a coffee? And I swear, like within 10 minutes, he'd replied to me on LinkedIn and he'd said, look, Dan, send me your number. So I sent my mobile number and he rang me 10 minutes after that. And, you know, it was one of those funny relationships where you just strike up a rapport. Yeah. And we were kind of, we were laughing with each other within the first couple of seconds. I don't know why, but I think the two of us found it funny that we had the same name. You know, it was that kind of ridiculous.
Small things.
Yeah, little things. So so anyway, he said, look, come down to the Intercontinental. Let's grab coffee and we'll have a chat about what you're trying to achieve. And so literally that day, it was the very same
really?
Day. It was the same day.
Like I think that's fascinating. Like, because a lot of people wouldn't reach out.
Yeah.
Oh no, like I'm not ready. He's so busy, blah, blah.
Yeah.
The answer is always no if you never ask.
Totally.
I do a lot of teaching and I keep saying, you know what the number one killer of businesses is? Oh, money, all these answers. I'm like, nope, you never start.
Yeah.
You never start because you're waiting for that moment. Oh, the time is right. Whereas like this is a perfect example of you knew there was a problem. You started, didn't go how you wanted. You kept going. But then you went again and you knew, oh, I've tweaked it now.
Yeah.
It's never a straight line. It's never this like, oh, yes, now we've figured it out. Because the problem will mutate. Things will change. You'll learn so much. But then that's a brilliant story of like within the space of a couple hours, I'm assuming the trajectory of where you were going changed.
Yeah. Well, that's it. And you know, there's like, it's just this roller coaster. And like, it's kind of like, you know, on a Sunday night, you're the happiest you've ever been. And then the Monday morning, you're in the doldrums, you know, and that's the roller coaster. But that was like, you know, that was a real high point. And I was like, Jesus. So
what did you want from him? What was your reason for reaching out?
My agenda was like really clear. I guess I courted him into the conversation on the basis of I want mentorship, I want advice, I want guidance. You know, you've been a really successful entrepreneur, you know, in the outsourcing world. You know, I have this idea for flexible legal outsourcing and, you know, I'd love to learn about your journey, which I, you know, that was the truth. I did want to learn, you know, from him how he'd done it. But I also had a very defined agenda around I want to raise money. And I want you to be part of this because I knew that, you know, that would make sense strategically. Mm. And I also knew that if I could bring in someone with, you know, with, I guess, Dan's kind of reputation in the marketplace, that would also court the interest of other investors. So we met up and like, I think honestly, within 15 minutes, Dan had said, look, I'll put in 150,000 euro. And that was the start of it. And so
no fancy pitch decks, just to pause on that.
No
fancy pitch decks, no 6 month build up. Just, do you know what it was though? The power of your clarity. Like it's so powerful. We chatted a little bit about this over coffee. Been clear.
Yeah.
This is what I'm going for. This is what I'm doing.
Yeah.
And just being yourself. Marry those two together and it's a serious force.
Yeah, and I think it's also like the power of rapport and dynamic between people and like sometimes that's luck because, you know, you get on with someone and they say,
just be sound.
I want to back you. Yeah.
Just be sound. Just be sound.
Yeah. Yeah. That's
it's overrated. It's underrated, I should say. It's massively underrated. Yeah. Just be sound.
Yeah. So that was it. And then that was really powerful because then I was able to reach out to, you know, a handful of other angels.
You'll never guess who's in. If he's in, you should be in too.
You've got the opportunity of a lifetime. So, yeah. So that was it. But
that was your anchor. That was your social proof. That was your anchor. You know, you need one to pull the others. Yeah. Yin and yang.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So we went off and then Enterprise Ireland they committed, I think, 200,000 euro to the project. And, you know, so we were able to raise like the guts of €1 million as a seed, which was really meaningful. And obviously having, you know, EI support and they've been there from the beginning. And that was another really key anchor because people were then saying, okay, this is being validated now by, you know, an outsourcing entrepreneur and also you've got EI involved. So it became easier then and there was momentum being built. So
you got to play the game a little bit. I think people try just outwork it. They try just, I'll just work harder. When in reality, social proof, who's involved, what's the shortcut? How do I understand this?
Completely.
It's massively powerful.
Yeah. So that was the start. And I think, you know, as they always do, the investment actually ended up taking quite a long time to go through. There was, you know, due diligence of sorts, not the kind of due diligence we're used to these days, but it was, you know, it was there, and people were, you know, very focused on making sure it was the right investment for them and there was going to be the right return at the end of the day. So it was like they all are, it was stressful, and it was, you know.
What slows down deals like that? Because you hear this all the time from entrepreneurs, you know, it takes three times longer, it costs you three times more. What kind of stuff, main stuff, because I know this is your area of expertise, but for entrepreneurs listening who are thinking about raising, what's the stuff that slows it down?
I mean, to be honest, like in that first fundraise, we didn't even have a deck put together. You know, like you touched on this earlier, literally didn't have a deck. I had a one pager, you know, but it was so unvarnished and unsophisticated when I look back. And I think that was a piece. So people were almost backing this concept and a sales pitch, but there wasn't the kind of, you know, I guess the information underpinning it where they could make an informed decision. So there was a piece of, right, Dan, you know, we like this concept, we like the idea, you know, we like you in terms of your commitment to the project. Now put something together, validate that there's a market opportunity here. So there was a bit of kind of back to the table and kind of drafting up documents and getting that in place. So that was 100% on us. And that was a consequence of us just being really inexperienced in terms of raising money at that point in time. And then I think there's also an element, and, you know, I've talked to so many people about this who've set up businesses. A lot of it's outside your control because, you know, particularly when you're raising money from a multiplicity of different people, people with individual intentions, you know, differing designs around what their expectation might be and how much money you need to raise and do you really need this? And it can become very complex.
As in they'll ask you for things, they'll ask you to clarify or change or what kind of stuff?
Yeah, but it's even, you know, it's even the smallest things, like, you know, this is just a hypothetical, but someone saying, oh, well, look, you know, you've said you're raising €1 million, but could you not raise 750, you know, and prevent a more dilutive impact on the rest of the shareholder base, right? This is like common stuff. So, That's the trickiness. I think you have to have real conviction around what you're doing, how much you need, and you justify that, and you stick to your guns. So, and then I also think, like, with due diligence processes generally, getting yourself prepared, making sure that you have all your ducks in a row, and, you know, whether it's legal opinions or accounting opinions or, you know, whatever it might be, there's lots that people want to make sure, you know, you have in place before they're willing to give you a...
How did you learn all that? Obviously, you came from a legal background, so that bit's kind of squared away, but all the rest of the stuff.
Do you know what? I was like, you learned as you went, because, like, we've gone, I mean, through four funding rounds all in now over the course of the last few years. So you are learning on the job. And then I think you bring in, there's experienced talent who, you know, you begin to tool yourself up with. And like one of the guys who joined us a couple of years ago, Paul, our COO, he'd come from Goodbody corporate finance background, qualified accountant, and this guy just, like, he'd done it before. He had a knack for, you know, putting this stuff together. So I was learning from him, seeing the way it was meant to be done. And, like, that was, like, super helpful because he joined when we were doing our Series A round. So that was the 5 million round.
What are the rounds you've done? Just bring us up to speed on the rounds
so
you've done.
Forgetting the first one that we talked about, there's been, so the seed of, you know, was in around £1 million, and there was 5 million with Series A, and then we've just done, last November we did 10.5 million with AIB. So.
Serious cash.
Yep.
Serious business.
No pressure. yeah, it is. It's serious cash, and there's a weight of expectation, and but we really have great people on the bus now, and you know, and AIB they've been really, really great. I think there was, like, when we did the last funding round, which, you know, AIB eventually joined us,
we had, you know, we were fortunate because we had a number of different funding options. A lot of, like, there was a handful of private equity businesses in the UK who we were looking at, and you know, they'd be really kind of good name private equity firms who I personally would have thought we were probably too small for them, but yeah, so we felt quite fortunate to have that interest. But I remember, like, AIB, we'd met the guys, and we used Goodbody Corporate Finance to broker the investment round. And I remember there was a feeling amongst us when we went into our very first meeting, which was with AIB, that this was going to be a dress rehearsal, basically. This was going to be, you know, look,
we'll warm up on this one. Yeah.
Make your mistakes. You know, this isn't going to be for them. But the moment I walked into the room, it was kind of terrifying, actually, because we went in and there was, like, it's about 10 people in the room, and it was like, you know, members of their legal team and their investment team, and it was like, I mean, they'd really kind of tooled it up. And so we
power move.
They were like, wow, this is kind of real. So anyway, I think they saw the strategic merit of, you know, what we do, even in the context of, you know, their legal obligations, the scale of spend that they have, and they could see the opportunity. So it was very much a kind of strategic play for them as well.
You've had a wild ride in a very short space of time. How do you manage that yourself personally?
I don't think I've always managed it that well, to be honest with you. Like, it has been a wild ride. Like the roller coaster thing is the best way to describe it. I always, my wife said this too. It's like, you know, that scene in Forrest Gump when he just keeps running.
I quoted that to someone 2 days ago. It's weird you brought that up. Just started running. Yeah,
he started running and he just never stopped. And, you know, it just. That's the way it feels. Yeah, that's the way it's felt. It's not as bad these days, but certainly in the, you know, in the earlier days, it was like, you know, you're in a cage fight all the time. And you know, there's no break. So I think, like, in terms of, I guess, the, you know, the coping mechanisms, in a way, it's exercise has been massive for me. Like, I'm committed now to doing at least 90 minutes of exercise a day, non-negotiable. And I, you know, I build that into my working day. I consider it a meeting. And I'm big on that. And actually a lot of our team are big on that too. So it's kind of become a kind of cultural focus internally, because people can see how good it is for you generally, not only your physical health, but your mental health as well.
I love that so much. That's just so powerful.
Yeah. I think it's necessity, you know, it's, and I think, you know, when it comes to, I mean, lots of people I know, you know, are struggling, they might be anxious or stressed about something. I think within an entrepreneurial context, you're living in this, like, this amphitheater of volatility and uncertainty the whole time. And, you know, you've got to find ways to mitigate against it. So I think exercise for me has proved to be the most powerful thing.
What exercise are you doing? What kind of stuff are you into?
I walk. I've got, like, nothing crazy. I used to go to the gym a lot. I now have a couple of dumbbells and stuff at home that I work on. But walking, I think, for me, is a big thing. Walking and free weights, press ups, not like nothing, you know.
But it's funny, like, when you're younger, you're like, oh, I must do this plan and this program and this.
Yeah.
And then I wear my whoop. I think you've got one as well.
I want to, yeah.
And then you see walk and you're like, yeah, wow. Damn.
Yeah.
These steps are actually mattering.
You know, I know.
I think walking was what lazy people did. I was like, no, I have to go for a run. I have to go for a gym. Or I have to play football. Or I have to do boxing. Or I have to do something. I'm like, damn, I'm clocking up.
Well, I've tried it all. Like, I had a punch bag. I've had everything, and I've torn rotator cuffs, and I've done everything. And then you realize, you know, you get to a certain age, which is kind of depressing. But, you know, when you start going out for a walk and you're injuring your calves and stuff, like, and you realize, right, I need to find something that's kind of low impact. And so walking has been amazing. So
for me, it's all about compounding. What can I keep doing?
Yes.
Every single day, like you said there about the 90 minutes, like, you're speaking my language. We're doing a challenge at the minute where they have to do 40 minutes every single day. it can be anything you want.
Yeah.
And I deliberately set it up that way. I'm like, it can be anything, but just do your 40 minutes.
Just get it in.
Because it just compounds. It doesn't really matter. We're not elite level athletes here.
Exactly.
You know, we're going for the 80-20. Can we do 80, can we do it 80% of the time and just do something? So like the compounding is big. You said there about the entrepreneurial life and kind of, you know, the stresses and strains. For me, like the impact is huge. My mental health and my physical health are just linked completely. Yes. And I think I never really got that until I started to kind of listen to myself a bit more. And we talked about over coffee, you know, it's not today you'll feel the effect. It might be tomorrow, probably next Monday. I'm kind of going, why do I feel so down? Because you stopped doing all the things.
Yep.
You stopped eating healthy.
Yes.
You stopped getting the exercise in. Because you viewed it as a luxury.
Completely. Like you have to be really deliberate about it and make it part of your working day. And, you know, and certainly I know we discussed this earlier, but like you see the tangible benefits of it. You also see the tangible disadvantages of not doing it when you stop. So,
and I think why it is that it's not immediate. Like I said there, you know, it's a slow decline,
yeah.
But it happens. You know, if you stopped exercising and instantly that day you had a massive pain, you'd keep exercising. But because it's a slow drip, it's huge. That's why I've started tweaking the message of the podcast. I'm like, you know, it's about, I speak to entrepreneurs about how they build their business, their body and their brain. Because for me, especially post-COVID, the realization is, well, without those three, like how often have you heard the story? Oh, you know, they build a great business and, you know, then 55, drop dead.
Yeah.
Weird, you know, don't know how that happened. He worked himself to death.
Yeah.
You know, literally, his body gave up on him.
Yeah.
And like, that's not the world I want to live in. And I think a lot of entrepreneurs have kind of had this realization going, that hustle porn mentality of like clock and the big days.
Yeah.
Oh, I sleep at the office and all the nonsense you hear online. You know, you see on Twitter, you'd be like, oh my God, like that's just not true. There are times you got to grind. We talked about this.
Yeah.
There's times you got to grind.
Yeah, do you know what? Like the truth of it is, and like I know a couple of guys who, you know, have set up their businesses, and I don't know, honestly, I don't know anyone who's gone and set up businesses who subscribes to that idea of I'm going to work 20 hours a day and I'm not going to keep fit or I'm not going to look after myself. Like I think there's a kind of a mythical thing that goes around it, but I think the truth of it is, in the absence of being very deliberate about your exercise and your mental health and all the other things around your business, you can't be as good within your business. So it makes you a better business person to look after those other parts. And like I do remember, like, you know, with the really stressful years when we were raising like the first fund, like I wasn't as present, you know, with, you know, having your first child and all those things. And there was no room for anything but just business. And exercise was, you know, was on the fringes. And, you know, everything became about the business and nothing else. And I learned really quickly that you have to carve out time for the other things that matter.
Like you've 24 hours in a day.
Yeah.
We all have it. You know, this thing of like, I'm so busy. Busy doing what?
Yeah.
And then when you analyze it yourself and you're kind of going dead time there, busy time there, like it's not how long you're there. And I want to talk about your working hours in a minute, because I think that's brilliant. Like, it's not how long you're there. What the hell are you doing?
Yeah.
I think some people, it's like a comfort blanket. They feel, at least I'm in the office, you know, at least they think that just by their physical body being in the office, that somehow that's a benefit.
Yeah.
When in reality, if they went in and did three solid hours and then went, looked after herself, went, looked after their mind. I'm not saying, look, do the 4-hour work week thing.
Yeah.
That's too far the other way. But there's definitely a healthy middle. You seem to be carving that out within yourself and the company. How are you doing that within the company then as well?
You know, like I think for us, like I think everyone subscribes to it within our business. It's the idea of productivity over activity. And, you know, when we talked on this earlier, but we brought in this working model at Johnson Hanna where the core hours become 10:30 to 4:00. Now that doesn't mean you do, you know, 6-hour days. It, you know, you do your working, your typical conventional working hours, but you do them in flexible ways. So it means that no one has to be sitting in rush hour traffic ever again. unless they choose to, but they don't have to be. And that means people can commit to exercising in the morning or, you know, in the late afternoon. And that's really important because it makes everyone better within our business. And I remember when we announced that, you could see, you know, just it was like levity. You know, people were just so happy. And it's a small thing. And, you know, and obviously
it's a small but an absolutely massive thing. I speak to a lot of people and you're one of the first people I've sat down across from who's had a clear idea and who's trying. Might be right, might be wrong.
Yeah.
But you're trying.
Yeah.
A lot of people are still doing the yeah, sure, we've hybrid. What does that mean?
Yeah.
How do people know when they're on or off?
Yeah.
Like, you need to give people barriers to work within.
Yep.
Yeah, we all want freedom, but we want a rough idea of what the hell is expected of us. Whereas when you're saying 10:30 to 4, that's when we can have a meeting. Yep. You know, and we know you're there.
Yeah.
Right? Powerful.
Yeah, and I think, you know, like what you find with people, like is people, and this doesn't sound great, but people will switch on and they'll do work at 9 o'clock. I'll do work like at night.
If you need to.
If I need to.
But you don't have to.
And it doesn't need, like, it's not about martyrdom or, you know, I'm the hardest working person in the world. It's not about that. It's just about knowing that if you need to get your car serviced, you know, in the morning and you need to drop the car off, you can do that and you can, and you're not going to be criticized or blamed or judged for it. So it's just those little kind of nuggets of flexibility make the most meaningful impacts on people.
Last Tuesday, I made a commitment to my wife. When our daughter was born, I was like, I'm going to take her to swimming classes. That's going to be my thing. That's going to be our daddy-daughter thing. That's how we're going to bond. And Tuesday, it was like Tuesday. They're around at random times. A, they're really popular, really expensive, and they're at random times. Tuesday at 10:30, I'm like, no bother. So like, I kind of carved out that time. And then she'd get her 6-month vaccines as well. I was like, taking her to that too.
Yep.
So we both did that. And then, but I was working until 10 o'clock because I was in town with Trinity from 6 to 9. I caught up on all my work in the afternoon. Magic. I did not care that I was working from 6 to 9. I was delighted.
Yeah.
So I was like, I had the morning from like 9 to 12 with her. Amazing.
That's it.
But that's how I like to work. And I think we talked about this as an entrepreneurial thing. There's definitely that in us, in our head, that you kind of, it's the game.
Yes.
Playing the game to your own level. And I think as you get a bit older and a bit more experienced as an entrepreneur, you kind of go, I don't have to do the 9-to-5 thing.
Yeah.
It's so deep how it's wired, isn't it, though?
It is.
It's deep within you from school, college, work, society.
Yep.
You know, things open at 9 and they shut at 5.
Yep.
You're like, why?
Well, like, thank God Gary's changing. Because it is changing.
Yes.
Like, I don't think we're ever going to see people working in offices 5 days a week again. I hope not, anyway.
Well, it's Thursday afternoon. We're in Dublin City Centre. It's so quiet.
Yeah.
The odd car is passing.
Not a out there,
there's a massive big office across from us.
Yeah.
Can't really see anyone in the windows. Like, that's the reality. And it's brilliant.
Yeah.
How do you look after your mind? Because we talked about the body, talked about the business. How do you look after your mind?
So, same again. Like, I think I try and read, although I find that quite hard these days. So, podcasting, listen to podcasts. That I find like really helps me. It cultivates creativity. It can be inspiring and it kind of takes you out of your own head. And then the exercise piece, that's the biggest investment I've made in terms of my mind and just trying to not overthink everything. I think like in the early years, sorry, not that we're through it by any stretch, because there's still lots ahead, there's lots of road left to travel. But I think, you know, you over agonize on everything. Like, every little detail matters when you look back, it probably didn't matter that much.
You think it's life or death.
Yeah,
sometimes it is, sometimes it isn't.
Yeah.
But you think it's life or death in the first kind of 3 years, I think.
Yeah, I think so. I think so. So it's perspective.
How do you gain that? Because there's a lot of people listening going, oh, it's easy for him to say they've raised 15 million. I'd be sweet if I was 13 million. But again, it's all relative, right? Because now you have different challenges and different pressures.
Yeah.
You know, we talked about earlier about, oh, wouldn't it be cool if you're a landscaper? You know, must be really, depressurized to do that. I'm sure he hates it on days as well.
Yeah.
But how do you do that? Because you've obviously cultivated that muscle.
Oh, I think the truth of it is, and this probably isn't that heartening, I think in the early stages when you're setting something up, it's really hard not to carry it with you at all times, because I think, you know, it's, I'm fortunate now that we've, you know, we have a far bigger team, and you know, you know, when it's like one, or there's two of you or three of you at the very start, and you are doing literally everything. Like I remember one of our first deals was with a massive law firm in England. And quite by chance, we'd gone over 2 days before, pitched them the idea of outsourcing their more non-bespoke work to us. And we got a call 2 days later saying, hey, we want you on the pitch. And it was for, a large bank who was based in the UK, who had gone to them and said, look, we don't want you guys doing that work. We want, an outsourcing business who can do it in a better way. Now, we'd obviously sold it pretty hard to them in terms of where we were at that point in time. And so, like, it was like that delirium when we won the gig. But this was this project was worth like €500,000 in 12 weeks. And but there was three of us, and we were putting this massive team together. We were trying to find project managers. It was bedlam. And then in terms of managing a project of that size, I'm like, we hadn't done anything like this before. So it was, you know, it was bedlam. That was super stressful. And like, there's no, I can't see any other way around that. Like you are bringing that to bed with you every night. You're not sleeping. We weren't. You know, now when we have projects like this, you know, there's an infrastructure, there's subject matter experts, there's lots of people who can manage that stuff, who are better placed to manage that than I was and the founding team. So this isn't very encouraging. I'm conscious that it's,
but it's real. See, this podcast is always about the reality of the story. I always say it's just people's stories. Like it isn't meant to be like a template or a guide or a blueprint. It's exclusive to Dan. This is a Dan story. Yeah. Dan did it his way. If I always say, if one person listening gets that aha moment, the whole pod is worth it.
Yes.
Because if one person just goes, that is the problem, whatever it is, personal or professional, it doesn't really matter. If one person listening gets something, I'm like, that's the job done. So it's real as well. Because there's probably someone listening who's 2.5 years into the business going, I'm doing it all wrong.
Yeah.
I'm doing it all wrong. It should be like this. And then listening to you going, sometimes you just got to dog it out, right?
Yeah.
You just got to get the dog in you, and you just got to get it done.
I've described it before as like a beautiful horror movie. Like it's like you know, and you use this line earlier, but you're like, you know, I wouldn't have it any other way, and that is the case. But like, it is at times horrifying, and you know, I think people have to be conscious of, like, that's in their future if you're taking this path. There's no one I know, yourself included, who's done something for yourself, built something, who hasn't had that experience.
Yeah, that's one of the best lines we've had in a long time. A beautiful horror movie. You'll hear me repeat that. But it's true. As I got older, especially in the last kind of 12 months, as I've done more work on myself and kind of my confidence, I'm now more black and white about stuff. And we talked about this. And like, I've kind of two modes now. I'm like, I always say, well, that's a choice.
Yeah.
If someone's saying to me, oh, it's this, that, and the other, I'm like, well, that's their choice.
Yeah.
They're choosing to live that way. They're choosing to be in that suffering. They're choosing to do it that way. I'm like, that's a choice. And then if someone comes to me and they're like, oh, I'm like, well, do you want to do something about it? Or do you want to just shut the fuck up? Because they're the two modes I'm kind of thinking about, that's right?
But there's no easy path. Like, there's not.
No. Yeah. You can't whine about it. You just gotta make your choice and move on. I even hesitate to bring this word into the conversation because I'm like, it's so overblown. How does AI impact what you're doing? Because when you started this back in 2013, I was like, they were well ahead of this game, because this trend is now suddenly people have woken up going, wait, we don't have to be in Dublin. We don't have to be in the office. What work do we not have to be doing either?
Yeah.
There's suddenly been this realization, whereas you guys had figured this out a long time ago. So what now, suddenly every Twitter thread is about AI to do this, AI to do that. Does this play a role, or is this still, you know, do you need experts involved here?
I had a nightmare. Do you know that show Westworld? Did you ever watch that?
Yeah, I watched it. I had to stop.
Yeah.
Because it was giving me nightmares.
So I was watching that the other day, and I was like, I got to stop watching this because
I had to.
About all this generative AI.
It was freaking me out.
Yeah, it was kind of scary. But Yeah, like, so we've been at Johnson & Anna, we've been using AI for years, and in different forms. But like, AI has been utilized by us to reduce the amount of human labor on large discovery projects, which is where the original business came from. And you know, now we're using it across, like, our biggest work stream now is in the contracting world. So we do commercial contracting for lots of the world's biggest companies, and you know, so we're using these systems to essentially reduce the human labor element of legal work. So in a way, I feel like we're quite well placed. We're in a way ahead of the curve in terms of the value proposition of leveraging artificial intelligence. But I think, like, for me, the bigger piece, like the more disruptive piece around what we've been trying to achieve, has actually always been more focused on humans. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and how we could, like, you know, I guess, like, it's proving that lawyers can be happy, whereas people never thought that was possible. So, you know, for me, it's more, you know, the creation of a more agile talent framework, a more talenting, you know, a more flexible talent engagement model. That's been the big piece for us. So, like, when I, you know, like, because people, you know, we talk about innovation all the time in our business, and yes, like, the technology piece has been massive, but, like, truly, I think what I'm proudest of is when I see, you know, humans who are in, you know, people who work for us who are working on projects in South America, you know, for people like Indeed, and you know, people who are working in America and Singapore and all these places where we've, you know, we've branched out into. And what we've given to those people is a different opportunity, a better way of working. And that for me has been the true kind of innovation. And you know, today, like in our business, people by and large don't tend to work more than 20 hours per week. And like, there's lots of, like, we have, there's a, one of our guys, Marion, she's like working from Clare Island, which is really cool.
That's very cool.
Yeah. She's working with one of the big tech companies and helping them on their commercial contracting. And, but it's, and we just have all these countless examples of people who've, you know, and they've come to me directly and on, you know, on LinkedIn and said, look, you know, this is where I was before. This is my life now. And that's because of this model. So that's the innovation.
There's magic in that.
Definitely.
There's a magic in that, because I think people overblow this. Oh, AI is going to destroy this, and AI is going to, you know, get rid of this person. It's going to get rid of this job. I'm like, no, you're missing the whole point here. Yeah. It's to leverage.
Yes. It's
for letting humans leverage to get rid of things that they're spending 20 hours a week doing rubbish. Like, yeah, you were saying, when you were in the early days, yeah, reading through boxes, yeah, of documents. Yeah. Summarize it down. What's the key points? What's the pertinent thing? And I see, like, humans now as like translators between the AI world and the real world.
Yeah.
They're in the middle translating, going, okay, I see this, I see this. And the inputs.
That's
it. People are just like asking AI questions. I'm like, you're missing the point. The point should be you're feeding it in all this information, letting it figure it out. And then you're going, okay, this is how we're going to use it.
Yeah.
It's incredibly powerful. I also think people are overblowing it. We're not. Like, it's companies like yourself who are already working in this space. It's not like, oh, suddenly I'm going to set up this AI company.
Yeah.
It's not what it's about.
No.
It's about companies who are already doing it. Going, we've been working on this for like 6 years.
Yeah.
Because we always think these things are suddenly here.
Yeah.
Like, VR was suddenly here 10 years ago. I ain't playing Call of Duty on my VR headset yet. When VR is here, that's when I'll know, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But even, like, you know, it takes time. New technologies take so long,
yeah,
to actually rubber to road. This is the fundamental difference. And it's companies like yourself who've done it. I'm going to do a quick fire round.
Okay.
You ready? You getting set?
I'm ready.
Okay. What book would you recommend every entrepreneur must read?
Business book that I loved was, it's a book called Mission by Michael Heyman.
Mission. Okay.
Love that. And that's the whole idea is, you know, purpose-driven companies are the ones that succeed. So focusing on building a business that's purpose goes beyond the mere generation of profit. That was really good. That was a really cool book. Another good one, I think, is my favorite book is, I can't pronounce his name, but it's called Silence by Erland Kagg. I could get that wrong, but that's a really good one.
What's it about?
It's about an Arctic adventurer. Oh. Who
Non-fiction or fiction?
It's non-fiction. Ooh. And he exists in silence. And it's just, I think for...
Is this one Gary shouldn't read before bedtime, or is this okay?
Gary, this will put you to bed.
Okay.
You will sleep soundly on this book.
I'm done. We've never had either of those two books recommended, so... Yeah, brilliant.
I think you like that.
If you wrote a book, what would the title be?
Oh, God. Silence or Scale.
Love it. What have you sacrificed to achieve your success?
I have definitely sacrificed lots, to be honest. Like, I think there's been a lot of sleepless nights, a comfortable working existence. I think, as you know, like you tend to live with your business. It doesn't matter where you are in that journey, like it's with you. So you can be sitting outside the coffee shop looking like you're totally chilled out, and you're thinking about, you know, who have I got on the podcast tomorrow, and, you know, what do I need to prepare for that podcast? It's with you at all times, you know, like you're dreaming about it, you know, you're coming up with solutions to problems in your dreams, you know, which is, so I think that's the sacrifice.
Blessing and a curse, right?
Yeah, completely.
It's flips out of a coin. It's the fine line.
Yeah.
What would you do if I give you 10 million euro today?
It's what we raised last year, so I'd be doing what I'm doing.
So you'd, no, I'm giving you 10 more. You can do it.
10 more.
I'm giving you 10 more. Fresh money, fresh, but it's for you. It's not for the business. It's not for John Snana. It's for you. You can invest in the business. You can invest in something yourself.
I would probably get into, back into the startup ecosystem. I love being around entrepreneurism, reinvesting, helping other entrepreneurs the way, you know, I was helped and still am being helped, contributing to that economy.
Okay. If you weren't an entrepreneur, what would you be doing?
Maybe the coastal gardener that we were talking about earlier. I don't know. I think I would like to be working within a startup kind of business building environment. Just having proximity to people who are building things from nothing, dreaming things into reality. So I don't know what that job is, but
somewhere in the ecosystem, you'd be still involved. Somewhere. I'm going to give you 1 million euro today, but you can only invest in one company or one person. Who or what is it?
I actually really like, I'm just looking at it, Whoop. I love this company. They don't need funding, but if they were coming, I love that. I love the idea of wellness and contributing to physical and mental health. So something like that would be.
Someone asked me the other day what my favorite brand was. I said Whoop straight away.
Very cool.
We were doing brand development and they flipped it back at me and I was like, Whoop. But it's true. It makes such a positive impact in my life. If you were starting a new company in the morning, what would it be?
Oh, God. What would it be? I like the idea of staying in something that I think helps. I think that helps people. I actually think, you know, some kind of a wellness company. And I'm big on diet and nutrition. I have an issue with the amount of pesticides on our food. Mm-hmm. And I would love to create a framework for showing people, you know, the healthier foods that they should be eating. Yeah. How much pesticides are on foods. I haven't even thought about this. I'm coming up with ideas as I go here. But something like that, you know, educating people around the nutritional benefits of certain foods.
Have you had your bloods done? A full blood work?
I did about a year ago.
Yeah, it's great. That was one of those moments where it just opened my eyes to like a whole new world. I fell down that rabbit hole. What do you believe other people might disagree with or find strange?
Oh, God. I think that idea of I don't know if people disagree with this, but I really believe in the power of following your instinct, you know, following your gut, your gut instinct. I know I've heard certain people say, you know, don't, that's kind of emotional stuff, you know, to be more prescriptive around decision making. I think there's, by and large, going with your gut is usually the right thing to do.
What would your final sentence of advice be to every entrepreneur listening?
I would say stay resilient and, you know, be prepared for the ups and downs, because, like, as we've discussed earlier, like, they will be there. You know, it'll travel with you. But if you've got conviction around what you're trying to achieve, stick with it and keep selling.
Beautiful. Dan, where can people learn more about you and the company?
They can learn more about me at johnsonhanna.com. We're on LinkedIn. We're on the usual social media channels. And you know, if people want to reach out on LinkedIn, go for coffee, I'm always open to that as well.
Beautiful. Dan, thank you so much. That was a beautiful conversation.
Thank you. I really appreciate it, man.
I hope you enjoyed that chat with Dan. It really was a fascinating chat. I learned a ton from him, and he's just a good dude. Wherever you're listening, whether it's on Apple, Spotify, or YouTube, do hit subscribe, hit like. It helps the podcast to grow, and that's what we're all about. I'll see you back here in a couple of days.